Hey guys, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for over 10 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures, how through them God has made himself known to us, and his ultimate desire to dwell among us.
We want to invite you to join us on this journey as God reveals himself to us through his word.
We also want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Well, we're back.
We are back.
I think it's the longest break we've ever taken.
It's been over 6 months.
Yes. We looked back and I think it was, June 27th that we made our last podcast. In fact, we struggled to even get the podcast stuff together. I was like, now which headphones do I use? I use these Elsa ones, right?
Yeah. And, which, by the way, I had previously, whenever we had gotten the new microphone, you got me the new microphone for Christmas last year.
Oh, yeah.
And whenever we had done that, I had been looking for my headphones that you got me nice headphones like the year before.
Christmas.
So like you've been like peace pardon me podcast material over time. Well, anyways, I had like lost my headphones and I had assumed that they had like gotten stolen at work or something like that. And anyways, so recently, actually at Christmas this year, I was reordering some things in the house and I uncovered the headphones. So now we have nicer headphones than what we started with.
But we're like, where do we plug this in?
Yeah, we had no idea where, you know, how to plug anything in anymore. The application for the microphone is all new.
It's like, so we have to update everything. It's a whole process. But we're back. And part of the reason we took some time off was, well, for one, we hadn't been doing... Prior, you know, we had not been doing as well keeping up with it as we would have liked. Mm-hmm. But then Garrett ended up doing a 13-week class, Sunday school class, about why Sinai still matters.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. It was really good class. It was kind of a, there was a lot from our exit. Like, I remember a lot of our Exodus podcasts kind of came into that class, but there was also kind of some new aspects as well that kind of really just tied everything in.
Yeah, because we took some time in Deuteronomy as well, which we've never done here for this podcast.
Right. So. And so that was really cool, but there was just no way that Garrett was going to, you know, prepare for a class every week and we were going to prepare for Matthew every week and do a podcast. And on top of that, Sadie did T-ball for the first time.
Right.
And Caleb did fall ball. And that was a lot of fun. I really do like going to there. Like, for as busy as it is with like going to multiple games a week, it is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And so Sadie loved it.
And Caleb loves it. So, I mean, whenever you're doing all that stuff, your kids are loving what they're doing. You wouldn't do anything different. And, all of that piling on, there was just no way we were going to be able to keep up with Matthew the way that we would want to.
Right.
And it just made sense for us to take a break. You know, it's like, it's just good to take a break every once in a while.
Right.
And so that all kind of compiled into it. And then, and then after I had completed teaching the class, just wanted to take a breather.
Well,
in general.
And it was like the holidays were coming up and it's just like, there's no way we're going to be consistent through the holidays. So we kind of waited until the new year. And so here we are.
Yeah.
And, to kind of refresh your memory, I guess, as to where we were in Matthew, we had just finished the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
Is really where we were at.
Yeah. And if I recall, one of the things that we had been calling it was the Discourse on Discipleship, which is what R.T. France calls it. To go back to that for a moment, it's really challenging. Like, it's absolutely challenging everything that Jesus says, in the Sermon on the Mount. And it's not a call, it's very much in alignment with the Torah, with Moses, with the commands of Yahweh as he comes down the mountain. It's, Jesus is essentially giving the law, with that. And he says at the beginning of it, I've not come to abolish the law or to get rid of it, but I've come to fill it up. It's not a, in that case, it, just like the Torah, it's not a prerequisite to being in the family of God. It's actually what being in the family of God, calls us to. mm-hmm. And how we're supposed to respond to the grace of God that he dwells among us. And so that the whole discourse on discipleship is Jesus saying, this is what it looks like to be in the kingdom. This is how we're going to act. It's not a call for people that aren't following Jesus. It's a call for those that do follow Jesus that have experienced his grace and the grace of God that, look, if you're going to be in the kingdom, this is how we act in the kingdom. This is the calling that we have. And it's not for grace. It's because of grace, mm-hmm. of which that we respond to it, just like it is in the Torah, that God's people are called to obedience after what God has already done for them. And it's in response to that of which we, you know, we do that out of love of our Creator, of love of our God who loved us first. And so all that stuff, all of the Sermon on the Mount is, he goes up the mountain to give it, just like Moses, you know, on Mount Sinai. And so what we're going to see is after this, so he's completed it and it, you know, he kind of had some different lines at the end of it saying, hey, you know, if you listen to me, you're like a man that's built his house on the rock. If you don't listen to me, you've built your house on the sand type thing, which is very similar to blessings and curses of Deuteronomy. And so now Matthew's going to pick back up on the narrative. Jesus is going to come down the mountain, and he's going to start actually doing things and living out the things that were talked about in the discourse, mm-hmm. that he's calling his people to, he's actually doing it. And you're going to see Jesus's interactions with different people. So we're actually going to actually have a narrative now where we had a long time of Jesus giving instruction. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to see a narrative and how he interacts with people. And in this section, I think chapters 8 and 9, we're going to actually cover, lo and behold, 10 different miracles that happen, which lines really nicely with 10 plagues in Exodus. But a lot of commentaries call that out and just note it and just mm-hmm. say, hey, here's something to pay attention to. And we're going to see, especially in this first section, we're going to see a lot of Exodus themes. So it's very good that we have studied Exodus before. So I think that'll really pop for us.
Yeah.
What specifically the ones that we're going to cover, the first three miracles that are here today, and just things to note with it is the types of people that Jesus is interacting with. So you would think that if somebody's going to start a kingdom, you would go to the people that are the powerful, and maybe one of these people would be, quote, considered powerful, but not within his context and culture,
right,
of who you would go to as a Jewish leader.
Right.
But all of these people are really people that seem like they're on the outside looking in most of the time. But that's where Jesus begins, and that's pointed, I think. And so we're going to note those as we go through kind of what their position is, why that would be specific. Why would Matthew bring that up? Why would Matthew start with that?
Mm, yeah.
Or why would Jesus start with that more particularly?
Really.
Yeah, exactly. So both of them see it as very important that the kingdom starts this way.
Yeah.
And so we're going to read this first one. We're going to see the first miracle that's actually recorded in Matthew. So you want to read this first section?
All right. When he came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately he was cured of his leprosy. Then Jesus said to him, see that you don't tell anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them.
Okay, so the very first person that he comes down the mountain, and it doesn't really tell you where he is yet. You would expect that this is somewhere outside the city. And the reason being, you know, like this is somewhere, I guess, on the outskirts or still in the wilderness area.
Mm-hmm.
It is because it's a leper. Mm-hmm. The very first person he comes in contact with in Matthew's story is a leper.
Yeah.
And, and this is a person who, now leprosy has a wide range of meaning, within the scriptures. It's not necessarily, you know, what I think what's typically thought of as elephantitis, where it's like, you know, decaying your whole body. You know, it's talking about a skin disease. It could range all the way from one that's killing you to one that you have that you don't really, it's for psoriasis, you know, mm-hmm. like what I have.
Unclean.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there might be somebody out front of me.
This guy could have had psoriasis.
Yeah.
For all we know.
So anyways, but because of the nature of leprosy, you're unsure, especially in ancient times. You're not really sure what it is. And so these people were taken out of society just to make sure that it didn't spread, for one aspect of it. The major aspect of it would be from Leviticus. Going back to Leviticus, with the clean and unclean laws that you'll see, I think it's like Leviticus 14 range, where it talks about people with leprosy and here's how you treat it. Here's how you make sure, you know, check it and whatever, if it's rotting and things like that. Anyways, they're sent out and excluded from society until it can be dealt with, until it heals. So that's what this person is kind of experiencing, and what they're going through. And I don't want to negatively play that, because we need to actually have a lot of, surely at this point in our time, we can have some sympathy for this, because if you just, all you have to do is think back 2 years from now or from in the past and know what we were going through with COVID, right? And no matter what your thoughts are on it, everybody was trying to figure out, like, how do we, if you get COVID, like, how do you separate out, and you would have like a 14-day quarantine, to make sure that you didn't spread it to other people, and the way that we washed our hands and, all of those things to try to keep the spread from happening. That's what's happening here in the ancient culture. And so that's, we should be able to have sympathy, for that and maybe some understanding. And it's also pointed that Leviticus doesn't say, like, all right, send them out and like, don't take care of them. That's not what Leviticus says. It's like separating them so that they don't spread. And then, the assumption would be reading over the whole Torah would be like, well, we still need to take care of them and make sure they're fed and cared for. But then, I think at some point it kind of turned to things that weren't in the Torah to like actually like excluding them from society in such a way that like they weren't cared for and things like that. So that's probably what this person is dealing with. Hasn't been around people for a long time, and has been, has been excluded. So he, like I said, he's a guy that seems like he's on the outside looking in. And this is the very first person that Jesus comes in contact with. So you have any thoughts on this first section?
Well, one of the, and I listened to a Tim Mackey podcast about this. I mean, it was like an hour long podcast, I think, about just this one.
Yeah.
Miracle, this one part of the story. And so obviously we're not going to spend that much time on this, but one of the cool things that I think he mentioned was that he said, Lord, if you are willing, as opposed to there's like an assumption there that he believes that Jesus is capable.
Yeah.
That he knows that Jesus is going to be able, Jesus can do this. I just don't know if he will or not. And how that is more questioning maybe the character of Jesus of like, would he bother to heal someone like me? Yeah. Someone who's unclean, someone who's an outcast in society. And Jesus' answer is yes.
Right.
And so like, that's just, to me, that was something that really stood out. And also, the be clean versus being cured, using those words, you kind of, I don't know. It seems like they, if you think about it, it feels like you could exchange and put cure in here, but cleaned has such a stronger meaning in this context because of the history with, I mean, because of their laws.
Right.
That it kind of like draws you back to other things besides just maybe this one, like a skin thing. You know?
Yeah. So in other words, his question isn't to his ability, but his willingness. And that like, And I think that kind of goes back to the right before this, whenever it says that he finished everything he was saying, everybody's like, who teaches with authority like this?
Right.
And so not only is he teaching with authority, but actually this leper assumes that he has authority to declare him to be clean, which, I mean, there's really only one set of people that can do that within this culture or within the Jewish laws, which would be a priest. And so he's talking to him like he's a priest, but also, it is pointed that he does use the word clean versus heal, which I know a lot of translations actually say you can heal me, which is such a shame to me.
Well, I mean, even in the version I read, it says immediately he was cured of his leprosy, yeah. But it has a footnote for that says made clean.
Yeah. But the clean actually has a more theological depth to it than cured. And the reason being, because if something that was unclean couldn't actually enter into the presence of God. So there were, in Leviticus, there's two things that really like seem like they can't come together. They're never supposed to mix, which is the holy and the unclean.
Mm-hmm.
Now to be unclean isn't morally wrong. It's a status that seems to reflect death and of which doesn't mix with the idea of God being the giver of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what it would teach you ritualistically is that God is the author of life, and the things that happen, like leprosy, like that's not within his will, or not within his, the way that he wanted the world to be. And so it's showing distinction between what sin has affected in the world versus the way that God desires it to be and what he wants to make it. You have this person who's a leper, he's unclean, and to be made clean, you know, there's got to be something that changes with him, either that he is healed and then whatever. But so you have his request is to be made clean, which if he's made clean, then that means that he can enter into the presence of God, and that he can enter into the tabernacle, you know, or go to the temple and, you know, make sacrifices and things like that. So that's a really pointed, it's a theological statement, more than it is, I just want to be healed. He's like, he's requesting to be able to enter back into society and to be able to enter into the holy dwelling of, or, you know, at least close to the holy dwelling of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that he hasn't been able to do. And so this next part of it, I find this really, really interesting to me, verse 3, and it says, in extending his hand. Okay, so the word there is he stretched out his hand, and it's actually the same exact word. In the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of your Old Testament or of the First Testament, it's the same exact word that is used for Moses stretching out his hand in the Exodus narrative. So Jesus stretches out his hand. It's like Moses, whenever he's the one through whom God works to bring about the plagues and things like that. He stretches out his hand and then he touches him. So again, this should make Jesus unclean by touching a leper.
Right.
Okay. But he touches him. And then he says, I am willing, be clean, and then he is cleaned. So something really weird is happening here that really hasn't happened before.
Well, and honestly, even if you think about it just in terms of, like, you were talking about COVID,
mm-hmm.
you know, when people had COVID, let's use the terms we're using, you know, from scripture here and say somebody with COVID is unclean.
Mm-hmm.
When that person who has COVID is unclean, you're staying as far away from them as possible.
Yeah.
You're not wanting to touch. You certainly, like, even doctors were like, you know, wearing hazmat suits basically to like go in and take care of these people.
And if you entered into that space with that person with COVID, then you had to go into quarantine.
Right.
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 Because you would be also, unclean.
Because you kind of became unclean.
Yeah.
So, I mean, kind of that is like a good recent example of like, really this making a lot of sense of just like, if I touch Sadie's snot, I'm probably going to get sick too.
Yeah.
Not like, oh, I have healed her.
You know? Yeah.
I wiped your nose.
Yeah. So something happened here that like, that seems like it, I mean, it's never happened before. And I'll make an exception for, okay. So, actually we just studied the Day of Atonement, in one of the weekly Bible studies, with the Act group. And one of the points Stephen actually made was, so for the Day of Atonement, one of the goats is they take its blood, right? And so blood is a representative of life, and they take the blood of the goat, and the high priest would sprinkle it on the atonement lid, so on the Ark of the Covenant, he would sprinkle it there, and it, he would actually start to move out and sprinkle the tabernacle and then the things inside the holy space, and then he would move out and sprinkle the bronze altar. So what ends up happening is that by the blood of the goat, the life of the goat that's given, the holiness of the blood actually cleanses what has been polluted by the sin of Israel. It actually cleanses it from the inside out. Mm. And so the priest works his way out. And so the idea here is it's permeating the blood that's given by the goat, which is Yahweh's goat, is actually working its way out and purging and cleansing inside out, you know, and actually going out from the tabernacle. And so not only that, but then whenever you get into like Isaiah 6, Isaiah finds himself in the throne room of God. And he says, I'm a man of unclean lips. I don't live among unclean people. And he's terrified, just absolutely just, he's like, I am going to die here. Mm-hmm. I should not be here. I'm before the holy God, holy, I'm unclean and he's holy. I'm going to be obliterated. And what ends up happening in Isaiah 6 is that the seraphim takes the coal from the incense altar, and he brings it to Isaiah, and he places it on his lips, and he cleanses Isaiah with the holiness, with the coal. And so what ends up happening is God's holiness overcomes and reaches out and cleanses Isaiah. And then Isaiah goes out and he does his thing, where he goes and becomes God's prophet. And so those are kind of two instances in the First Testament where you have something holy coming in contact with the unclean, with something unclean, and it actually cleanses the thing that is unclean. And so here, it's really odd, but it's actually not something that was unforeseen. Mm-hmm. It's actually a sign of the Messiah here, that the holiness of God is going out, and so here it cleanses. It's a statement of God's holiness going out from him.
Well, and the other thing about this that I think is interesting about this story is, we're going to see in future stories and future miracles, God, that Jesus just says the word and it happens.
Yeah.
You know, so like God didn't have, like Jesus/God did not even have to touch this man for him to make him clean.
Sure.
But I think it's pointed that he chose to because he knew what that would mean.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so it's about more than just the cleansing of this person. It's about a statement of like really showing who he is in this moment.
Yeah. And it's a statement of God is intimately involving himself in humanity's plight. As I mentioned in Leviticus, leprosy is really it's a symbol of sin and how it affects people. You know, it spreads, it permeates, mm-hmm. and, you know, it just jumps from one thing to another. It doesn't just affect you, it affects everybody. And so it's used as a convenient symbol for sin. And so here to see, I mean, God is going out and he's dealing with the sin in an intimate way. He could speak the word, but he chooses to involve himself here. Jesus could just say it, but he chooses to touch him. Mm-hmm. And that's really intimate, you know, and something that both this guy needed probably, you know?
I mean, the idea too of like, when was the last time anyone would have touched him?
Yeah.
You know, like giving him a hug or anything. Like, I mean, I kind of imagine it as being like Jesus touching his arm, like his upper arm close to his shoulder, you know? Yeah. And like, I mean, think about that. Like some people have a, you know, physical touch is their love language,
yeah.
You know, and to not, you know, to not have a hug or a high five or a, you know, anything for maybe as long as, I mean, he's obviously desperate.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And one thing to note is that, I do think within Leviticus, there's a longing and a hope that God will deal with that. But, yeah. But even within this culture, I do think that, yeah, R.T. France notes it as well in his commentary that he says that, look, you know, healing from leprosy would have been on par with saving somebody from death, you know, mm-hmm. like raising somebody from the dead. It's unheard of.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it, and he notes this as well. He says, like, you know, it's no small gesture. In today's world, we would recoil from the, you know, the thought of coming into contact with somebody with a highly contagious disease. For them, this is even heightened beyond that of a person. If it's unclean or, you know, and anything common comes into contact with this person, would be ineligible to approach the holy place. If anyone had been near enough to see what happened, they would have been horrified. Yeah. Like, that's how serious this is, that mm-hmm. he touches him. And I just want to note that. And so that's the route that Jesus chooses to take. And it's not that he's undoing it, or he's like disobeying Leviticus. He's actually doing the thing that God had always, that was always longed for in Leviticus, because there are laws that is like, hey, whenever this happens, whenever somebody is cured from leprosy, then here are the things that you're supposed to go through, which is the things that he instructs him to go do. He's like, keeping in alignment with the beginning of chapter 5, I'm not here to abolish the law, but fulfill it. This guy's going to get to do probably what nobody has ever gotten to do, which is that he's going to the temple, and he's going to go show the priests, like, look, guys, I'm healed. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I can enter back into this. And this, and actually, this would have been like an 8-day ceremony, I think is how long it took. Yeah, 8-day ceremony at the temple. And I think sometimes we can think about that as like a, man, he's got to go through 8 days of like ceremonies and things like that. Like, that's going to be boring. And I just see that as like, I imagine him being like, for 8 days, just being so joyful and thankful, to God. It's an opportunity for him to just be there in the presence of God that he hasn't been able to be in, you mm-hmm. know, for a long time. Because of what Jesus has done. And so it's going to be overflowing, thankful time that yeah. he has, like his whole travel to the temple, which is going to take him probably days. And then he spends 8 days there. And I just imagine it being a time full of thanksgiving and praise. A former leper could hardly be expected to reappear as a healthy member of the society. So whenever when he does come back into society, everybody's going to be asking what happened.
Well, I mean, think too, everything is taking me back to COVID. Mm-hmm. Cause like when you're out of like at that time, I mean, I remember at one point they even suggested like a 21 day quarantine mm-hmm. or something. Imagine when you come out of a 2-week quarantine, it's kind of exciting to like yeah. get to go out again and do things. This is like another level.
Yeah.
So, or for two sure. or three, you know, like this is a big deal. So yeah, I'm sure that was exciting and not, you know,
yeah.
Oh man, I got to do that.
Yeah. And it just is. Yeah. And so this is another moment of, emphasizing what Matthew has been emphasizing the whole time, of that God dwells among us, that mm-hmm. Emmanuel, God is with us. And his holiness is now going out from his temple, which John would say that, you know, or he would make note that Jesus is the temple. He's the true temple, the dwelling of God. And so we see him doing the things that really were supposed to happen at the temple.
Yeah.
The dwelling of God is here, and it's emanating, the holiness of God is emanating out.
Yeah. Well, cause you do have this little last verse here that's like, don't tell anyone, but mm-hmm. tell the priests. And yeah. that feels a little like, wait, what? Like,
yeah.
And so if you don't know the context here, it's kind of confusing. Like my initial just glance of it was like, don't tell anyone but the priest. But like, because originally I was thinking, don't tell anyone, keep a low profile, right? Jesus yeah. has a lot of time before he's got things to do before everyone's like, who's this guy and what is he doing, and get all upset with him. But the thing that Tim Mackey pointed out to me, and it's like what you were saying, it's like God's holiness is not limited to the physical temple that they had
right.
built.
Right.
And anymore because of Jesus. Yeah. And so I thought that that was kind of like, yeah, he is going to ruffle some feathers here with this, but it like needs to be known.
Yeah. And also with the statements that are in chapter 5, you get the feeling that somebody's on the lookout to be like, look, Jesus is disobeying our law.
Yeah.
And he actually pointedly doesn't want that to be something that people think. Yeah. And so he's actually having him go and do as Moses commanded.
Do what he should do.
Do as Moses commanded. He's totally in alignment with it. You know, so like I just hate the dichotomy that we seem to make between like Jesus is like, no, I don't hate, I hate the law.
Punching back.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. He's totally in alignment with the law of Moses. And, so he tells him, go do this thing. And he's making sure that he's staying in alignment with the law of Moses. And so anyways, I think that's pointed there, at his last statement at the end. You good?
I'm good.
Keep going. All right. So now when he entered Capernaum, a centurion approached him, appealing to him and saying, Lord, my slave is lying paralyzed in my house, terribly tormented. And he said to him, should I come and heal him? And the centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only say the word and my slave will be healed. For I also am a man under authority who has soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and he does it. Now, when Jesus heard this, he was astonished. And he said to those who were following him, truly, I say to you, I have found such great faith with no one in Israel. But I say to you, that many will come from the east and the west and be seated at the banquet with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be thrown out into the outer darkness. And in that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said to the centurion, go as you have believed, it will be done for you. And the slave was healed in that hour.
So to start this off, just kind of like we started the last one off, of who this person is that's approaching Jesus. And that's a centurion.
Mm-hmm.
And just to kind of, because I don't want to assume that everyone's like, oh yeah, centurion, I totally know what that is. So this is a Roman soldier who would be over a lot of men.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you were talking about people of power, this would be somebody who has a lot of power, but would be kind of seen as sort of an enemy of Jesus because he's a Roman, right? And so, I don't know. The Chosen has really helped me kind of visualize a lot of this stuff. The Chosen is, well, I say a TV show, but, you know, it's only streamed. Like, I don't know. Yeah. It's so weird to talk about TV shows now.
Yeah.
It does come on weekly now. They release a new...
Yeah, they've been doing new episodes every Sunday.
Mm-hmm. But that kind of really helps me see the relationship between Jesus and his disciples and the Romans.
Yeah.
And just the tension there of like how Rome really just has their thumb on the Jews and really just kind of like monitoring everything that they're, you know, keeping the peace. I'm doing air quotes with that of just sort of like, making sure everybody stays in line and that chaos doesn't erupt. And so Jesus would represent someone who might bring in chaos because of the things that he's doing and the things that he's saying.
Yeah.
And the Chosen has helped me kind of see that.
Yeah.
And so when I read this, I can kind of see like that there would be like the apostles would be like, wait, should we interact with this? Like you're going to help this guy. But yeah, so it's a person in power, but not like a high priest or, you know, it's not on the Jewish side. It's on the Roman side. And so there would be some tension there.
And so, I mean, and likely this is a person, he's not necessarily a Roman citizen per se, but he's drawn from a non-Jewish population.
Right.
So what they would do is they would, you know, the Romans would conquer people and then they would take people from that conquered land, and then they would send them somewhere else to be there. So they would like flip-flop people So this person was probably, you know, Phoenician or Syrian or whatever, and they were sent here to be their, you know, their centurion.
Yeah.
But this is certainly somebody that is not Jewish.
Right.
They are not from Judea. They're not from the Galilee. They are somebody, they're a Gentile person who is considered outside of Israel, especially mm-hmm. for the people of this time. They're Gentile. They're not one of us.
Yeah.
They don't belong here. You know, this is our promised land. You know, you can kind of get a feel for how it would be. They're the occupying force. No matter where you're from, you're the occupying force. You're the ones that are oppressing us.
Yeah.
This person is directly associated with that. Whether or not they are or aren't, they're going to be associated with that. And so, yeah, it's where we had a leper before. Now we have a centurion who's a Gentile, very clearly not in, you know, within the Jewish people. Now, the Luke story of this will talk about how this person helped out with, I think, with the synagogue and things like helped them out. Matthew does not make that point. And actually, in Luke, it'll be that he sends some of his servants instead. But Matthew, really wants to drive home the point that this is a Gentile with Jesus.
Yeah.
And that interaction, he really wants to drive that home as to what's happening here and what Jesus is doing.
Right.
This centurion, he comes to Jesus, and he calls him Lord, which is right out the gate. This is an occupying force. This person is the one that should be an authority here.
Right.
And whether it is a nicety, you know, just of respect or not, or if it's like something higher than that.
Like a sir.
Yeah, if it's like a sir or like a an address of him as deity.
Right.
Either way.
Yeah.
Both of those would be like, would be starkly different than you would expect.
Yeah.
A centurion would not come up to a Jewish rabbi and call him Lord.
Right.
He would say, "You're under my boot.
Right.
Do what I say.
Right.
Do what I tell you to." So that right out the gate is immediately not what you expected. Very, very similar to like in Jonah, whenever the people that respond to God are those that didn't know him. You know, the Gentiles are the ones that cry out to him in Jonah. So anyways, he calls Jesus Lord, and he's interceding for his slave, which here it could be a son or a servant. It's most likely just a servant that he has, a servant that he very much obviously cares about.
Yeah.
That he's come out here to this Jewish rabbi and pleading with him to heal him. What's interesting, verse 7, it says, you know, I will come and heal him, but this is more likely a question. Within the Greek, it's much more likely a question that would be said, basically, you want me to come heal him? You know, it's like a question of like, why are you coming to me? Like, Jesus is kind of drawing out an answer, which is what he'll do later with another Gentile, the Phoenician woman, or the Canaanite woman. I don't remember how Matthew puts it. But he's going to draw out an answer here. But it's kind of a question of like, you want me to come and heal him? Like, you know that like that's not how these things work around here, right?
Yeah.
So he's drawing out an answer from the centurion by asking him a question of like, why do you want me to come and heal him? And so then the centurion gives him an answer. So any other thoughts from you on this, I guess, the healing and the centurion responds.
I mean, just the respect and faith in Jesus that this man has. And again, I had this thought about the man with leprosy too, of just like wondering if these people, if both of these individuals were at the Sermon on the Mount and kind of, cause I mean, I know before the Sermon on the Mount, we had that, I think Matthew briefly mentioned some like healings and stuff that Jesus had done. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they had only heard about that through rumblings, but it's interesting to think that the Sermon on the Mount is really like what took this to another level of people hearing about his message or being there.
Yeah. And the authority, again, the thing that that Matthew highlights at the end of it is his authority.
Right, right.
Of which is getting highlighted here.
Right. And and that's what makes me wonder, like, were some of these people just like, and again, The Chosen kind of made me realize, maybe some people were like, heard he was going to be having this, you know, sermon.
Yeah.
And were just interested, maybe not thinking that it would reach them in some way, but just like curious as to what he was going to say that might rile up people or whatever. But like, I just kind of wonder if that kind of really spurred this respect for him.
Yeah. Well, and another thing, just to add some context here, is that Capernaum is going to be the place where Jesus makes his, like, basically his home base.
Right, right.
So everything, the majority of the stories within the Gospels, they're going to operate out of Capernaum. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where he's around in the Galilee. It's actually right on the Sea of Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
And so the majority of his ministry is going to operate out of Capernaum. And so this guy could easily be familiar with him and have seen heard things that have been going on. But certainly the way that Matthew writes it, it seems like it's on the heels of the authority that Jesus has clearly demonstrated in the Sermon on the Mount.
And right.
Somehow, I guess that word has spread about that. And this, you know, this Roman soldier, the centurion, he clearly sees in Jesus authority that he understands in a way that nobody else has been able to recognize. Where he's saying, look, I know what it means to be able to just like tell somebody to do something.
And I think that
not only do you have that sort of authority, you have a higher authority where you could speak the word. He fully believes that you can speak the word and heal my servant, my slave.
Yeah.
And so
without being in his presence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is clearly what's on the table here and what this centurion thinks that this Jesus can do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really highlighting the authority of Jesus as God. He's doing the only something that God can do.
Yeah.
And so, anyways, Jesus is overcome by that faith that the centurion, or the recognition that this centurion has been given, that Jesus can do this, and he's like, "Look, I haven't seen faith like this in anybody in Israel." It's pretty negative towards Israel, I guess, to say, look, such great faith, nobody in Israel has demonstrated this. And he kind of uses that as a leapfrog in this situation as a leapfrog to make sure that he drives home that he addresses the same thing that John the Baptist addresses in the early chapters of Matthew, where John the Baptist said, told the Pharisees, I think, and the Sadducees, look, you put your hope in just your heritage.
Yeah.
But I tell you, John the Baptist told him, look, God can raise up sons for Abraham from these rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And so he uses a common motif that's throughout the First Testament that is of the banquet of God. And so, you know, like, so he starts with from the east and the west. So you've probably heard this before, you know, from a Casting Crown song, right? Mm-hmm. Like casting our sins as far as east is from the west. But he uses this east and west language. So from like Psalm 107, it'll say, let the redeemed of Yahweh declare it, those whom he has redeemed and from the hand of his enemy and gathered from the lands from the east and from the west, from the north and the south. So all the redeemed coming from all over from the east and the west, or from Isaiah 43, if you must not fear, for I am with you, I will bring your offspring from the east, and I will gather you from the west. So it's talking about Isaiah 43. It's talking about the ingathering of Israel, and they're in exile. They're in exile, and he's gathering them in. So he's using language about the ingathering of Israel from their exile, and he attributes that to this centurion, that from the east and from the west, which you would have thought, or at least within their with probably within their culture at the time, they're just thinking about that being the Jewish people of the diaspora being brought back, God gathering them back. But Jesus is making a point to say, look, this Gentiles are included into this, not just those of Israelite descent, but everybody. And then he goes on to say, he makes the point even further of saying that they'll be seated at the banquet with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. And this is, again, another continued motif that the kingdom of heaven or the banquet, so like Isaiah 50, 25, we talk about, on this mountain, Yahweh of hosts will make for all peoples a rich feast, a feast of aged wines, fat filled with marrow, and filtered aged wine. This ingathering, the feast of God, that you're what was always longed for, maybe even since, so when we read Exodus, I think 24, Exodus 24, when they ascend the mountain, they feast mm-hmm. with God. Isaiah had a vision, he longed for a time whenever God would not just gather the people of Israel, but would actually gather Gentiles. That was within the First Testament and of what God was going to do. And so Jesus is saying, look, this Gentile is a perfect example of his faith is a perfect example of God gathering in all the nations, not just those of Jewish descent. And so he's not, I think often what ends up happening with this is people would, say that Jesus is like throwing out Israel and God's reconstituting a whole new Israel. And really he's redefining it, redefining what it means to be a child of Abraham, really within the context of what the First Testament already said, which is that, to be a true child of Abraham was to, what did God ask of us? To seek justice, to love mercy, to walk humbly with our God. These are the types of things that the remnant of Israel would be. And so he's redefining it as those who have faith like Abraham, not those that just are merely blood born of Abraham.
Right.
That the true son of Abraham, a true son of Abraham has faith like Abraham. And so he's, redefining and flipping, not even flipping on his head, but just relaying the foundation of what it means to be a children of Israel.
Yeah, it's not just bloodline, like your DNA.
Yeah.
And honestly, I wasn't sure. Mine says, but the subjects of the kingdom, it uses the subjects. That's how it's worded.
Yeah.
I looked at some other versions and it's talking about the sons of the kingdom. And that helped me understand a little bit more that is talking about Israel and Jewish, Jewish people.
Yeah.
And I think it's so easy to focus on this like weeping and gnashing of teeth and just go, oh my goodness, like Jesus is scary. Kind of thing without and lose the picture here of Jesus basically saying, I'm including more than just bloodline Jews.
Yeah.
I'm here for more than just the line, the direct line of Abraham.
Right.
And I don't know. I think that really helps to see the bigger picture of understanding that this is saying like you don't get to feast at the table just because who your mama is
right.
or who your daddy is,
And yeah, it's about your response and your attitude towards God.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us can respect that.
Yeah.
Of like, we don't like it when people just get to do things because of who their mama or daddy is we have problems with that all the time in our society of like, well, that's just, because who he knows or who his parents are or whatever. And so to see this of like, no, we're including more. It's mm-hmm. about your heart towards God.
And it's about what God has always desired, which is communion and a feast. Like they're reclining. It's literally they recline at the table, recline mm-hmm. at the banquet. And this is a familial picture that includes the nations. And that's a filling up of the scriptures that Jesus is bringing about here. And so Matthew's putting that right in front of you and saying, look, God is including This is something that the first century church is easily dealing with. Well, they're not actually easily dealing with it. They're actually having a really hard time with it.
Yeah.
Of what it means to follow the Jewish Messiah as a Gentile.
Yeah.
And so this would obviously play a part. Matthew is kind of informing through this narrative what God is doing for the Gentiles and what they're seeing and what they're watching happen right before their eyes whenever all these Gentiles are coming to follow the Jewish Messiah. I want to give that context because Matthew's writing into that world that you're seeing Jew and Gentile coming together, in the church. This would be really important for them. So where with the leper, the intimacy of God is really highlighted to me. Here, the authority or the intimacy of Jesus and God. The intimacy of Jesus and of God is really highlighted there. Whereas here, the authority, I feel like, is really, really highlighted.
And also, I
want to know that this isn't just license to say, you know, just believe it and it'll be done for you. You know, like, if all you got to do is just believe, mm-hmm. that's not the point. The point is the authority of Jesus. That's what Matthew's really trying to drive home here, and the inclusion of the Gentiles. This isn't a narrative for name it and claim it. It's a narrative that shows us the inclusions of the Gentiles into the family of God and Jesus' authoritative power. Those are the two things that are really being highlighted mm-hmm. here. I think those are the take homes for it. You have any other thoughts on this section?
I think that was it for me.
I will note these types of things that Jesus says is why it's really important to know the First Testament or Old Testament. Is because he's using language from that,
mm-hmm.
and that's really going to trigger some people. And like knowing, you know, whenever he uses that language from Isaiah, where you previously might have thought that like this was just for the Jews, whenever you go back and look at it, you look really hard at it, you're like, wait, there's more to it. And so it's keying in, especially for a Jewish audience, to go back and read
mm-hmm.
And go look at those passages. And so that's why it's really helpful to. It's one of the reasons it's really helpful to know your First Testament so that you can better understand Jesus. So you want to read the last section here?
When Jesus came into Peter's house, he saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand and the fever left her, and she got up and began to wait on him. When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmaries and carried our diseases.
Okay. So here we have the last of the three that we talked about before. And this is Peter's mother-in-law. And so the reason that I've kind of highlighted that, you know, of the outside looking in, I mean, it's a woman. So he goes mm-hmm. to this apparently older woman, is, you know, Peter's mother-in-law. So these three people are the first people that Jesus heals. It, you know, you think if you're just wanting to like go for power and things like that, you go to, you know, I guess you go waltz to Rome and say like, all right, Caesar, what do you want me to, you know, who do you want me to heal so you can gain power? But like he goes to kind of the least within their culture. He doesn't go to the powerful, but he goes to, to Peter's mother-in-law, is who he chooses to go to. So he goes here. And again, it returns to this touch. So again, I think that, where the previous one was about Jesus's authority, I think it, the narrative effect for it shows that he could obviously just heal her with a word, but he chooses it, this intimate moment,
mm-hmm.
To be near to her. So the idea is that this transcendent God who is above us and has no business even caring about us, that he desires to be near to us.
Yeah.
And I think that that's continually played out throughout the scriptures, that God desires to be near to his people. And so where he could, we've already been told that he could speak a word and it be done. He chooses now to, he touches her, and then, you know, and she's healed. So you have any other thoughts on this?
Well, so One thing that I think is really interesting, and I literally just noticed it, is this is the first one, and honestly, the first one that I've noticed that, like, really ever, where somebody is not asking Jesus for help or to be healed. Jesus sees a need and he addresses it. Mm-hmm. I guess it could have gone down differently, but just from what we see here, and I don't know what, like, other, you know, gospels, like, say about this in particular, but just this idea of, like, he comes into Peter's house, which, if you watch The Chosen, is kind of home base. Which I don't know if that's necessarily, again, I mean, Jesus is basically homeless. But Capernaum is kind of, in general, their home base.
Yeah.
And so to me, I see Jesus as kind of like having a long day and finally being a place where maybe he's more comfortable and where maybe people won't be like, Jesus, help me. Jesus, you know, can you do this? Like, tell us more about this. And not that those things are wrong, but kind of finally in a place where maybe he wouldn't be so needed. Mm-hmm. And he immediately sees a need and he addresses it.
Yeah.
And I think that that is something that is really cool. And especially since it is probably older just because it's the mother-in-law of Peter. So somebody who probably, I don't know what her role is in society.
Can you heal the younger person over here? Like, they got more to live for.
She can go get water for us. But, you know, like, I don't, even if she's healed from the sickness, I don't know if she's going to be going to the well to get, like, water for the family.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe, but.
Well, I think that, I mean, Matthew's clearly chosen what he wants to talk about. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's going to say, look, there were other people that are demon possessed, you know, and he healed all kinds of people. He chose these three stories for a purpose.
Yeah.
To tell a particular, you know, give a particular picture of Jesus, which is that, you know, he didn't exactly choose the what would have been the most powerful in this Jewish society. The people that you would expect for him to choose, you know, this is where he went. And so he could have chosen any, you know, probably a number of stories, and clearly he says he could have. But he chooses these three, and I think it's because of her, her location, you know, within the society. And then, you know, chooses to, I think it's pointed that she doesn't ask, actually.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's different than the other two.
Yeah.
Is that she doesn't seek him out, but he sees the need and fills it.
Yeah. Did you have any other thoughts about this section? I kind of go off on a little bit of tangent with my notes, so I kind of wanted to.
Well, I do, but I figured I would just finish it with this last part of that he himself took away our sickness.
So you want me to do my...
Yeah, why don't you go ahead.
So as I was reading these... you know, these three sections, I was like, oh my goodness, Jesus, just like everywhere he goes, like as soon as he arrives, someone wants to be around him. Mm-hmm. And I know I just pointed out like Peter's mother-in-law wasn't like needing him, but right after that, it's like evening came and there were demon possessed brought to him and he drove out the spirits and healed the sick. And I'm just thinking, oh my goodness, like that would be so overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
To just constantly have people coming out at you, needing things. And so it kind of made me think of like, no wonder Jesus often went off to be alone and rest and recenter, himself with God, because people are always asking him of things and they had good reasons to.
Yeah.
But that's just a lot.
Yeah. It would be really easy, I think, to become pompous with this, really, to become arrogant. And you know, I think that that's what a lot of those, you know, solitude moments for him are, recentering on the kingdom, you know, and remembering like he's doing God's will, you know, and, mm-hmm. And that type of stuff. So like, I think that it would be exhausting, and it would also be tempting to become arrogant.
Yeah.
You know, with all these people following you, you know, you could think that, man, I'm just,
Because like as, thing, as which I, it was, but as I'm reading this, I'm thinking about the mom that I get every day.
Yeah.
Not that I'm putting myself in Jesus' shoe, like me and Jesus, one and the same. That's not what I'm trying to say. But just the constant of people needing you and wanting something from you.
Yeah.
It just is a lot. And sometimes you really do have to make sure you are going and recentering yourself and connecting yourself back to God. And I also got to thinking about the Sabbath and just how like that would have been vital for him in his ministry to have that. Like we talked before about how that's such a gift, how sometimes we see it as a burden, like, oh, you can't do anything on Sabbath.
Right.
That's a gift.
Right.
Like it's a, you don't have to do anything on Sabbath. And so to think about Jesus really needing that, it's almost like God knew he would need it. But just like how necessary that would be. But it just, it also is kind of reminding me of like, Jesus knew that even though these things were hard and they were tiring, that this is what he needed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so to kind of take us out of this story for a second, it got me thinking about things that Garrett and I have been going through of like not really knowing always where your purpose lies or what you should be doing or where you should be and when you should be there. And just how sometimes doing the right thing or doing good things are also really hard. And that doesn't mean you should stop doing them. You know, it just is what it is, you know? And, like we've had the struggle with like, what is our place?
Right.
Like, where are we supposed to be
in
church?
Yeah. And largely it feels very, you know, just, we often feel like we're kind of in the wilderness a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like we don't know who we are anymore sometimes. And, you know, for such a long time, I had such an identity with youth ministry. And that's not something I do anymore. And so now, like, I've been trying to, it's almost like ever since then, I've been trying to figure out, like, what my place is.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be really lonely sometimes of, like, knowing, like, yeah, where do I belong? And what am I supposed to be doing? And sometimes you don't get the answers to that immediately.
Right.
And honestly, we don't feel that right now.
Right. Okay, and me and you, we are two different people with two different, you know, sets of strengths and weaknesses. And so, but yet we are unified in our marriage. And so want to go in a similar direction, but it's like, where does that take us? Mm-hmm. You know, like where can we do the things most effectively that suits both of our strengths and weaknesses? Yeah. And so that can just be a really hard thing. And I guess seeing these scriptures just made me see the drain and exhaustion that Jesus probably felt behind the scenes. And I don't know, kind of was something that I, even though it's not specifically mentioned, something that I kind of resonated with what we've been kind of going through mentally lately.
Yeah. And we will see that, I think, as we go forward, a little bit more on that. So to finish this off, Matthew actually ends that section with he references back to the First Testament, right? And he quotes Isaiah here, and it's actually really common Isaiah chapter that gets quoted a lot throughout the New Testament, and how they came to understand Jesus and everything he did, because when everything threw down, nobody knew what to think. And so they were going back and reading the scriptures, and they were like, it being almost informed of, oh, this is what Messiah was supposed to be. And this was what Messiah did. And almost learning about Jesus in that way as well. And so Matthew actually goes back, he takes these three stories and he references back to Isaiah 53. So in Isaiah 53, it's pretty well common. Let me see if I can pull it up here. Where it says, you'll recognize it. We quoted a lot at Easter, right? On Good Friday. It says like, you know, for he was like a shoot before him, and he was like a root from dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should see him, and no appearance of which we should take pleasure in him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of suffering, acquainted with sickness, or with, I think often you'll hear sorrows with that. And like one from whom others hide their faces, he was despised. And we did not hold him in high regard. And then this is what Matthew picks up. He will quote from the Septuagint, I believe, or some variation of it. And he would say, however, he was the one who lifted up our sicknesses, and he carried our pain. Yet we ourselves assumed him stricken and struck by God and afflicted. So let me go back to Matthew 8 on that. So Matthew, what this is often quoted to is to say, look, the Messiah was supposed to suffer, because they're trying to understand, why did Messiah die? Mm-hmm. And, you know, why did that happen? Like, that just, all that seems foolishness. And so they quote back to Isaiah as one instance to try to help make sense of that. But clearly that hasn't happened here. And so Matthew is quoting from this and saying that he, you know, that this healing section was a fulfillment of the scriptures, and saying that he himself took away our sickness and carried away our diseases. In other words, what Matthew doesn't just see what Jesus did at his death, burial, and resurrection as a fulfillment of the scriptures. He sees the entirety of his ministry as being a fulfillment of the scriptures. Not that he would suffer, but also that he would carry our pain. And that he would carry, that he would deal with our sicknesses and things like that. And something to note here, when you go back to Isaiah, in Hebrew, the whole part of he carried away our diseases, that's the Hebrew word nasa. And you would recognize it from Exodus 34:6-7, where it says that Yahweh, he proclaims that he carries, that he nasas, he carries the sin, iniquity, and transgressions of his people. And then you'll see it again. You'll see it multiple times, because it's the word carry, to bear. But you'll also see it again on the Day of Atonement, whenever there's a second goat. We talked about the first goat earlier. There's a second goat of which the sins, transgressions, and iniquities are confessed over the second goat, and it carries, it nasas, their sin and guilt into the wilderness. So Isaiah is very much picking up on that theme, but Matthew very clearly sees everything, that not just Jesus's death, burial, and resurrection, but the entirety of the ministry of Jesus as a fulfillment of the scriptures.